welcome to another Founding Friday or Founders Friday. What do we call these things? Founders Fridays. Have you guys been watching them? We have a new studio audience here tonight. Have you guys been watching the Founding Fridays?
Yes.
Okay. Have you learned a lot?
Yes.
How many of you had heard of George Whitefield before, what was it, last week or the week before? Three people. Four. It's it kind of changes your outlook on things, doesn't it? Things are starting to make sense. The more you learn, I used to ask the question, how did we get here? Are you beginning to understand how we got here and where we need to go again? So let me ask you this, because tonight we want to do revisionist history. We want to correct some of the things that are happening, not just with the founders, but all across the board, and show you some of the examples of where history is just wrong. You know, one of the things I learned when I first started doing television, it was so spooky. I was over at CNN, and spooky for many reasons. But I was over there, and it was one of my first days. I said, hey, do we have that story on such and such? And they said, yes, Glenn, it'll be just a second. It's being ingested into the system. And I'm like, okay, that's spooky. Ingested in the system. And I think, do we use the same language here? Is it, you know, yeah. It's a giant system, and what it means is when the story is done, it's put into the system, and then it can be called up anywhere in the world inside of the Fox system. But what it made me think of is, what happens if the first person or the second person that's ingesting the story gets it wrong? Because every time you write a story, you bring up all those other stories and you check it against to make sure the facts. If somebody's gotten it wrong, every other story after it is wrong. That's the problem. That's kind of what's happening with our history. Ask yourself these questions. Now, you may, because you've been watching, you may know the answers to some of these. But a year ago, would you say that Washington was just a die-hard Christian? Would you say that? Yes, or who would say yes? A year ago? Okay, so there are four people. Woodrow Wilson. I didn't know anything about Woodrow Wilson. I mean, a year ago, would you say, I don't know, I guess he was an okay president. Okay? If you didn't know if you didn't watch the show, he was a horror show, wasn't he? A horror show. Possibly the spookiest president we've ever had. The New Deal. How many of us grew up in households that said, the New Deal saved America? Okay? All did. Now that you're learning something about the New Deal, did the New Deal save America? What was the Great Depression called in the rest of the world? Thank you. Just the Depression. Right here. Just the Depression. Just the Depression. It wasn't great. They didn't try to social engineer their way out of it. FDR. This one I've always... And once this light went on in my head, I thought, wait a minute. FDR. Did the American people love FDR? Did they? Let me ask you this. If you have a president that everybody loved, why would you, the minute the guy's body is cold, rush to the Capitol to write a law that says, oh, by the way, we got to stop term limits, we got to put term limits in right now? Why would you do that if he was so great? It doesn't make any sense, does it? A good portion of the country, they had to amend the Constitution. That's a big deal. A good portion of the country was terrified. They knew what kind of power this guy had amassed. Yet we don't read about that. But nobody even asked that question. CPI. Has anybody ever heard of CPI?
Chicken in every pot or something?
Chicken in every pot? No. That would be CIP. CIEP. It was actually under Woodrow Wilson. If you spoke out against the government, okay, or any of the policies, you could go to jail for 20 years. We had 30,000 people put in jail during World War I for speaking out. If you read Cass Sunstein's words, it's these policies. Woodrow Wilson had spies. Woodrow Wilson had what he called four-minute men, where they would step up in the public square and they would give four-minute propaganda speeches. And they were selected in each city by, are you a mover or a shaker? Are you somebody people will listen to? It was propaganda. How many people think the Nazis were the best at propaganda? How many people learned that? Rice?
Yeah.
Okay. Goebbels, right? They were great at it. Do you know, if you read the diaries of Goebbels, do you know, I remember I had one of my staff members, I said, look up propaganda, read this stuff. He was reading the diaries of Goebbels. He came into my office and all the blood was drained out of his face. He said, can I read a passage? Do you know where Goebbels said they learned propaganda? Woodrow Wilson's administration. They learned it from us. They say that's why they lost World War I, and they knew if you don't get into propaganda and you're at least as good as the progressives in America, you're going to lose. And how about this one? If I told you that $2 trillion went missing and Donald Rumsfeld stepped to the podium and said, by the way, we can't find $2 trillion. We're missing that $2 trillion. Would you believe that story? Ever heard it? Watch the monitor. Watch the monitor.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
According to some estimates, we can't find $2.3 trillion. Did anybody notice the date on that? Day before 9/11. So, the point is, history's got it wrong. You don't know about history. A lot of the stuff is revisionist intentionally. A lot of that stuff is happening because progressives need you to believe FDR was loved and the New Deal saved America. When the truth is, the thing that they have deleted from history, can anybody tell me about the Depression of 1920? Nobody. The Depression of 19... You can, Stephen?
A little bit.
Tell me what you know.
I remember the GDP dropped down to 50% of what it was. And it was turned around in basically 2 years by cutting government in half.
Okay. Woodrow Wilson, progressives, gigantic government. We went into a depression as bad as 1930. Okay? That's staggering. Harding and Coolidge get in with Mellon, and they say, we're going to cut taxes, I think, from 75% to 24%. And we're going to cut our budgets, our spending, in half. The Roaring Twenties. The Roaring Twenties. History has been deleted and selectively put in. All you know is, oh, the Roaring Twenties were greedy. No, no, no. That's a problem with the people, not the system. That's a problem with the people. Why do they just focus on the Roaring Twenties and not tell you what got the Roaring Twenties? Because it doesn't help their narrative of giant government. So you have revisionist history doing it intentionally. Sometimes you just get it wrong because it's like it's ingested and it goes into the system, and then somebody else reads history years later and they're like, oh yeah, well, that guy, he's trustworthy, and he got it wrong. Other times, things just happen. We're missing $2.3 trillion. You can't account for it. September 11th happens and our priorities change. We've never gone back to that story. How many things do you think are true that aren't? And what does it mean for the course of our country? Tonight, we're going to try to get into some of that. And we have a couple of experts. We have Peter Lilback. He's the author of George Washington's Sacred Fire. It's a fantastic, fantastic book, Peter. How are you?
Thank you.
Have a seat. We also have with us Jerry Falwell, Jr. He's the chancellor of Liberty University. And via satellite is Burton Folsom, Jr. He is the professor of history at Hillsdale College and the author of the book New Deal, Raw Deal. How are you, Burton?
Hey, I'm doing fine, Glenn. Thank you.
Tell me the thing that you found out about FDR and the New Deal. I mean, did you know all the, when you started doing your research on how skewed history was?
No. I was surprised. I knew we had had a lot of problems under Roosevelt, and the Great Depression, after all, lasted a whole decade. It was 20% unemployment in the United States, only 11% in the rest of the world. I didn't really understand why until I began to study Roosevelt's policies.
Did you, you know, I have up here on the board that people loved Roosevelt. Tell me who Henry Morgenthau was.
Henry Morgenthau was Roosevelt's Secretary of Treasury.
Okay.
The two men were great friends.
And they had, it wasn't, Morgenthau was really kind of one of the architects of the New Deal.
He was.
Okay.
He'd been a friend of Roosevelt's for 20 years. They did a lot of socializing together, and they had lunch and dinner together, and they were great friends, and cabinet meetings were important to both of them.
Okay. Now, take Burton off the screen for a second, and I want to show you a quote from Morgenthau if we have it. This is what Morgenthau said I think it was 1939. Do you have it up here for the screen? He said, "We are spending more money than we have ever spent before, and it does not work." This is the Secretary of the Treasury, 1939. "It does not work. I want to see this country prosperous. I want to see people get a job. We have never made good on our promises. I say after 8 years of this administration, we have had just as much unemployment as when we started, and enormous debt to boot." Can you imagine the Treasury Secretary saying that? And he's one of the designers. He's one of the designers.
He's one of the architects.
So, Burton, how and why is that just erased from history?
Well, I had to pull it out of the archives in the Roosevelt Library in Hyde Park, New York. But it's an important quotation, and it shows that even the New Dealers themselves, Glenn, recognized after two terms of all of this spending, doubling the national debt, it had not worked, and unemployment was still higher than almost anywhere else in the world.
Okay, so now, Burton, give me the 1920s, the untold story of the 1920s. Give me some of the facts we just talked about, roughly,
sure,
the depression of the 1920s that no one knows. Give them to me.
Well, the 1920s, they're that decade in between Woodrow Wilson on one hand and Franklin Roosevelt on the other. And it was a decade where the progressives were not in power. Wilson was out. Roosevelt, Franklin was not yet in. And so what we have are Harding and Coolidge in the presidency. And what we see is that depression starting in 1920, 1921. We have unemployment at 12%. We have a lot of people arguing what we need is a stimulus package, government programs to build roads so that cars can drive on, that sort of thing, with government expense. Harding and Coolidge say, no, we're going to trust our entrepreneurs to do the job. We're not going to try to micromanage the economy. They end up cutting the tax rate from 73% eventually to 25% at the top levels. And what we begin to see is a tremendous outpouring of entrepreneurship. We get, radios are invented and expanded. We get air conditioning developed in the 1920s, and the implications of that for the American South are tremendous. We get talking movies invented in the 1920s. Even the zipper and Scotch tape are all inventions of the 1920s. We cut taxes, we turned entrepreneurs loose, and that decade was tremendously prosperous. We ended that depression. We went from 12% unemployment in 1921 to 2% unemployment in 1923.
Burton, would you say that, I was thinking this the other day, that Ronald Reagan said that if freedom fails here, where will the rest of the world run? And I was thinking about that phrase the other day, and I thought, we are the place that John Galt ran to in Atlas Shrugged. That's America. But it required everybody there to not look for a handout. And what the progressives try to do is make sure there are no peaks and valleys, that there is no good times and then a crash and a good time. That's not possible to create. There'll be crashes, and there were crash after crash after crash. But they were short-lived crashes. We didn't go through long periods. They were just short-lived. But those highs, that nobody concentrate. Everybody tries to concentrate on the Roaring Twenties as being an age of greed, but it really wasn't for the average person. The average person the life changed for most Americans in the 1920s, probably more dramatically than maybe any other time period up to then?
I think you may be right, Glenn. We had a doubling or more than a doubling in college enrollments. We had a higher rate of literacy in the 1920s than we have today in American
Holy
society.
God.
You get in the 1920s, Glenn, unemployment drops. In the Coolidge years, the unemployment is 3.3% average, inflation 1%. That's the lowest misery index of any president in the 20th century.
Real quick, I have to take a break. I just want to finish up this segment here with Roosevelt.
Sure.
Roosevelt, am I wrong by saying there was a good portion of people that thought, holy cow, I'm glad he's dead, he was turning into a dictator?
Well, there were a lot of people who thought that, and as you pointed out, we immediately had a constitutional amendment to prevent any other president serving longer than two terms. Part of Roosevelt's success.
Just so people don't, because constitutional amendment, it doesn't happen anymore, explain that that's not a one-party thing. You can't get a constitutional amendment through with one party.
No, you had more than one party involved in this. Some of the Democrats went along with it as well. Many of the Southern Democrats were upset with Roosevelt, and the Republicans as well. And we just decided that two-term limit was the best idea, that it had not worked well with four terms of Franklin Roosevelt.
Burton, thank you very much. And I want to leave it there on Roosevelt.
Sure.
And now I want to go to George Washington and Sacred Fire, because two terms... There was a reason it was two terms. A reason. I'll explain in just a second. All right, we're back with Peter Lilback and Jerry Falwell, Jr. from Liberty University. And, Jerry, I don't mean to make you sit here quietly for a second, but I want to talk to you in the next break, because you're a chancellor at a university. And you are trying to set things straight in your university. And I want to talk to you in a minute about how difficult it is in that position and finding professors that won't buy into the revisionist history. this is just such a tremendous book. And I want to talk to you a little bit about, because what you do in this book is you say, okay, here's the theory that you read about in the history books. And they say this. And then you just, it's an avalanche of information. I mean, it's just, it's startling. There's so much proof that they're wrong, and it's all footnoted. When you were writing this about George Washington, when you first saw this stuff, did you have any idea on how wrong they have gotten George Washington?
The only way I knew Washington was through his writers, through his historians. And everyone said he was a deist. He mocked the scriptures. He only used it for humor, if he ever did.
And hang on just a second. In case you don't know what a deist is, because they're not real popular. And they weren't back then either,
no.
Right? A deist is somebody who believes in God as a watchmaker. That he started things rolling and then, okay, have a good time, guys. I'm going to go over here and play pool. And so it's just a machine that's running now. He doesn't believe in Jesus or anything else, right?
Okay. So if you're a deist, why bother to pray? Why do you need a clergyman? Why do you need religion? Because God had started, he's gone. I was convinced, because I had read scholars, that that was the case, and my heart was really kind of despairing. Mm-hmm. And I started reading the quotes that those very authors had, and I said, wait a second, that text they're using to support Washington as unbeliever that he wrote has a Bible verse in it. But apparently the scholars who were reading didn't know what the Bible was. Well, if you don't read the Bible, how are you going to recognize a Bible verse?
Mm-hmm. It's like the Declaration of Independence. It's riddled with Bible verses.
That's right.
It's riddled with them.
So I started going through, and lo and behold, in the very books that were advertising the unbelief of Washington in his texts, there they were, filled with reference. I said, these guys don't see what they're seeing. They can't be right. And so I was astounded by the time, 15 years later, working on it, just how much material there is to show that he had a vibrant, personal Anglican or Episcopalian Christian faith.
So you believe that this was a error of history, that they just didn't know, or this was a purposeful change in him?
I think there's an element of both. We can really see a shift that occurred at the bicentennial celebration of Washington's birth. That's in the early 1900s, 1930.
Wait a minute, the Progressive Era?
The Progressive Era.
Who would have guessed that? That's weird, okay.
In other words, a devout, evangelical, Christian founding father didn't play well for those that wanted to move beyond Christian influence in government,
right,
and Western civilization. So they needed a more secular Washington, and scholars found a way to present him in that form.
I have to tell you, I know what is on top of the Washington Memorial, and I know the stairs, but the way you describe it, I'm going to see if I can take the cameras into the Washington Memorial, because it needs to be seen, and I think there's a reason it's not seen anymore. Explain what's on the top of the Washington Memorial in Washington. Nothing can be built higher than this, right, for this reason, and the stairs.
So here's this obelisk that towers over the great city of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And every morning as the sun comes up, it gets to see only the words that God and the sun can see. And it's in Latin, praise to God. In other words, here was a life who said his whole goal was to bring praise and glory to God. That's Washington's own words. He said, that's the passion of my heart, is to bring honor to God who made me.
The stairs
as you walk up. You can't walk up them today. They'll make you take the elevator. Of course, they think your heart can't handle it.
Sure.
I think it's a form of historical revisionism. They don't want you to see as you go up the stairs that there are Bible verses from the Proverbs all the way up to the top that were supplied by American people as they built that building as a
testimony
of faith.
Each state and different organizations built it, right?
So it's filled with different regions, with scriptural messages, filled to the glory of God, reflecting the kind of faith that America had, believing, consistent with their founding father. I hope you can get the cameras in there and show them someday.
Yeah,
you need to show the nation.
We will.
Because it's extraordinary.
We will.
Apparently, I can't prove this, but I've heard that there is a copy of the top of the Washington Monument that's on display in a museum in Washington, but it has been carefully turned so you can't see the Latin words, so you won't have the ability
Tiffany?
To ask...
Tiffany, our
yes.
executive producer, will you find out if that's true or not?
We will find out if that's
all
true.
All right. Watchdogs.
I've heard that said
email.
So many times, it must be true. So what I would love to have happen is to say, all right, you keep hiding the text that's on the top, but let's put a camera over and see what you're not letting anyone else see.
Okay. Back in just a second. We're back with Peter Lilback, Jerry Falwell Jr., and Burton Folsom Jr. Let me go to the first junior, Jerry Falwell Jr. You're at Liberty University. Do you have a hard time finding professors that will teach?
No, because we don't have much competition for professors who have the values that are important to Liberty, the ones who are willing to teach true history about our founding principles. We have a unique mission in that regard. So, no, we've not had trouble finding teachers, but we do screen them very, very closely.
What is your name there?
Shoshana.
Shoshana, you were saying in the break, that how old are you?
I'm 17.
You're 17. And do you learn any of this in school?
I have learned none of this. I mean, I would have loved to, but I've learned absolutely none of it.
We see that a lot with students from public schools who are taught that the founding fathers were anti-God, anti-religion, that they didn't want any mention of God in the public square. And so we really have to have a special course that's required of all students called Foundations of Government to something that sort of does what the public schools no longer do, that brings them up to where 16-year-olds were a generation ago.
Can I ask you a question? Because there will be people that are watching, and they will say, well, see now, this is just a bunch of religious people that just want religion taught and crammed down. For instance, I have no problem. You want to teach evolution as a theory.
And we do. We use the same textbooks as every other university. We teach it as a theory. We also teach some of the flaws of the theory. We have many students who transfer to Liberty because of the lack of academic freedom at secular universities.
Right.
They're ridiculed because they are conservatives. Their professors use the F word to describe them in class in front of their students. And so they come to Liberty because you can discuss all views and all thoughts, but conservative views are just anathema at many public universities.
So, but what I want to ask is, if you're looking at the history of our country, and you know George Washington, any doubt that this man was an amazing, God-fearing Christian? Didn't he try to build it? Wasn't our army a Christian army? His words, not mine.
That's right. He called them Christian soldiers defending the dearest liberties of their nation.
Okay. So you have that going on. People will say, well, you're just trying to build a big Christian army here. The truth about the founders, and Peter, I'm sure you know this. I don't know if you know this. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but... Mm-hmm. They were the biggest defenders of other religions.
That's correct.
Were they not?
I believe they were.
Yeah. I mean, they were the Father Abraham story from George Whitefield and Sam Adams when they got together in the First Continental Congress. Do you know this, Peter?
Yes.
Yeah. So they got together and they defended. They would go around and testify in court for other religions. Here you are, an evangelical university, and you asked me, a Mormon, to speak. A lot of people have a problem with that.
Protestants, people of no faith, Jewish people, who just believed three core issues. They believed in support for the state of Israel, strong national defense, and...
abortion.
And pro-life. And those were the three issues that united those groups, and... That was all it was.
But isn't that, Peter, what the founders were trying to get to? Your father was just really repeating, and that's what we need to get to again, is people being, as Thomas Jefferson said, if it neither breaks my leg or picks my pocket,
okay,
what difference does it make? It doesn't affect me. We need to get back to where we're tolerant of other people's views. It doesn't mean that we don't vigorously defend our point of view, but we are tolerant of others' faith, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to me that we're entering a bigoted, the people who are called bigoted, are the ones who are saying, no, wait a minute. I don't have a problem with teaching that. You do.
That's why we have so many students transfer to Liberty, because they're faced with religious bigotry at other universities. And we believe in diversity of ideas. We don't put any cap on what can be discussed. It's just there's more freedom at Liberty, I'm told by students who've been there 2 or 3 years, than at secular universities.
I have interns that go to school at several universities here in New York. They don't feel comfortable saying they work for me or for Fox. Mm-hmm. They don't feel comfortable. I mean, I've had one of them say to me, No. I mean, we joke. It's the Glenn Beck Witness Protection Program. I mean, it's amazing. Okay, we'll be right back in just a second. With Peter Lilback, Jerry Falwell Jr., and Burton Folsom Jr., and I want to make a correction here in the monologue. And Burton, you can correct me here on this. In the opening monologue of the program, I said that Woodrow Wilson had 30,000 people in jail. We think the number was how many? 2,000, 3,000 people?
I don't have the number, Glenn, but a lot of people were jailed. I mean, Eugene V. Debs, the head of the Socialist Party, was in jail. A lot of newspapers were shut down, especially German-American newspapers, absolutely shut down. A lot of civil liberties problems under Wilson.
Okay, and real quick, because I just want to go, I've been concerned about the new Supreme Court justice saying, if you're caught off the battlefield and you've written a check to Al-Qaeda or a terrorist organization is what they say, we can hold you without a trial or due process indefinitely. And, you know, with all the stuff of talking about the Miranda rights and just, you know, suspending your rights as a citizen, et cetera, et cetera, people say it can't happen here in America. Burton, would you like to tell me about the citizens under FDR that lost their rights?
Of course. Yeah, of course, we had under President Roosevelt, we had Moses Annenberg went to prison for an income tax violation. But Lyndon Johnson, who also violated, had income tax violations, had the IRS called off because Johnson was critical to helping Roosevelt in the state of Texas.
I was actually I was actually thinking about the Japanese Americans and the German Americans that were here. I mean, we rounded them up.
We rounded up over 100,000 Japanese Americans, and we put them into what they called relocation camps.
Oh.
And Roosevelt signed the order for that. We had evidence that we could have let them out very easily in 1944, but Roosevelt would not do so because he thought it might hurt him in carrying the western states when he was running for his fourth term for re-election.
Never forget, my grandparents were big supporters of FDR, but that was the one thing they kept saying, because they lived right down the street from a Japanese American family that had lost the farm, everything else, and they just thought it was just criminal, just thought it was absolutely criminal, and it was. So let me go here. The university system before, you know, during the revolution, et cetera, totally different than it is now.
Yeah, before you spoke at commencement the other day, we had a baccalaureate service the night before, and I reminded the students that the baccalaureate service was started at Oxford University in 1432. Every bachelor had to give a sermon in Latin to graduate. The tradition continued into American history because most universities here were founded to train ministers of the gospel. But now, because of the revisionist history of the separation of church and state, it's no longer allowed at public universities. So I reminded them that's one of the privileges that they have of attending Liberty University. We continue that tradition. But there's so much revisionist history. They're not taught about how FDR tightened the money supply, increased taxes, and lengthened the Depression by 15 years. They're not taught that John F. Kennedy lowered taxes and had years of prosperity, or that Reagan...
JFK would even be welcome in the Democratic
Party. No way. Ronald Reagan lowered taxes, and we had years of prosperity. They're not taught any of that, but that's the purpose of Liberty University. That's what we are.
I hate reading history books now without a ton of original sources all through it, because they're guessing. They're not really going back to the original. And this is, there are two lies, I think, that are so powerful. One, that you're not qualified to teach your children. You got to have some expert do it. And two, you need a historian to tell you. Wythe, he taught George Washington, and it was all original sources. That was the idea, wasn't it? Go back to the original source, not somebody's interpretation of it.
Well, that was the beginning of Western civilization as we know it, going back to Erasmus at the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. The phrase was ad fontes, go to the fountains. Don't listen to what some scholar tells you, because he may be lying to you. Look at the text, and that was in the biblical sense. What does the Bible say? What did Augustine say? What does Calvin say? What did George Washington? What does the Constitution say?
Isn't it amazing how when you get away, when somebody says, don't read the Bible, you come to me for that, and I'll tell you what it says. Mm-hmm. When you create that system, you create a system of corruption. And that's what we've created on everything. 100 years ago, people used to argue the constitutionality of things. When the Dred Scott law was passed in the Supreme Court, people stood up and said, hell no, that's not right. It was the court that did it. It was the people that said, not over my dead body are we going to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, they knew, but now we just look to experts. They just said, who the heck are they?
There's a famous dictum that historians use, and that is, the living can make the dead do any tricks that they find necessary.
Back in just a minute. Do you ever lie awake at night and think, man, I just wish I had a juggler on hand to help me explain the role of government interference in our lives?
Or maybe just a big pile of Monopoly money to make sense of foreign debt. Lucky day for you. Look no further. Just record this show or DVR it every day at 5 p.m. Eastern. I mean, I'm there for you, baby. You know what I'm saying?
Ooh.
I think I made most of the audience just throw up in their mouth just a little bit. There's nothing like a little Glenn after hours. Did it again. Remember, midnight snack and a side of me. They took away my M&Ms and they replaced them with grapes because of the war on gins. I am grossing America out like crazy. Make sure you join us every day. DVR or record the show. 5 o'clock Eastern. We're back with Peter Lilback and Jerry Falwell Jr. Also, Burton Folsom Jr. is with us and a studio audience here in New York. Start in the back. What was your question or your thought?
Well, I was going to say, in middle school, I only learned 1 year of American history. And now, in high school, I'm only learning 1 year of American history, which is this year. Every other class, freshman, junior, and senior, we learn European, world. You don't learn American history. So, we got to have more years of American history.
Is it true that there, because I've read this and I don't know if it actually passed, there's one state that is now trying to push that there will be no American history, it'll only be global history, prior to 18, I think it's 80.
I hadn't heard that.
I'm pretty sure that's true. Mm-hmm. And it's coincidentally about the time that the progressives started to come around. Yes.
No, well, my question is, why is this not being taught in our schools? Our children should know this here, that this is it's scary. What I'm learning today is what's happening right now in our present. And it was saying, if you don't know your history, you're designed to do the same thing again in the present and our future. Our kids should know this. This is very, very spooky. I'm very, very afraid just learning what I'm learning now because it's still going on now.
Burton, let me ask you that question. Can you answer that? Because you're a guy that studied the New Deal, and you also know Woodrow Wilson. I mean, can you not look at Woodrow Wilson and almost see what's coming next with this administration?
Well, you can, because Wilson did not like the Constitution. The Constitution was too limiting.
Right.
Wilson wanted to redistribute wealth, take from some, give to others. Not equality of opportunity.
Would you say, because I never got the impression that FDR had contempt for America, but I think Woodrow Wilson did. And a lot of people would speculate
right.
That maybe Barack Obama has a little contempt for the history of America or Western civilization. Do you see a pattern or a similarity between the two of them in that?
I think in that instance, you're right. Franklin Roosevelt, his ancestry went way back, and he did, in his own way, have a love for America that Wilson and Obama simply do not quite share. At least they don't share any kind of deep respect for the Constitution.
Yeah.
Wilson thought it was outmoded, and so does Barack Obama.
Right. It's just that they don't necessarily hate it. It's just that it was a nice little thing, and it's in the past, and let's move on from that. Right.
It worked in 1776, but today we can trust leaders with more power.
Right. And didn't, who was it? I think it was Wilson said, don't read the Declaration of Independence. It has that the, you know, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness was for then only. And the Constitution
right.
also, we're only supposed to read parts. We're not supposed to read the preamble, right? Isn't that what he said?
Yes, he just didn't like the idea of equal rights for all. He liked the idea of no checks and balances. He wasn't liking that centralized power.
Okay, back in just a second. I want to thank our guests and leave Jerry Falwell Jr. with the last word.
Just want to end by saying Liberty University will continue to teach that economic justice means what the founders meant. If you earn the money, if you work hard, you keep it.
God bless you. From New York, good night, America.